Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 26th of May. Our main stories: the World Health Organization suspends testing of a drug President Trump has taken to ward off COVID-19. So what are the risks? No apologies from the British Prime Minister's senior advisor after he travelled several hundred kilometres during the lockdown.
No, I don't regret what I did. I think reasonable people may well disagree about how I thought about what to do in these circumstances, but I think that what I did was actually reasonable in these circumstances.
And the German government agrees a nearly $10 billion rescue package for the airline Lufthansa. Also in the podcast: the influential jazz drummer Jimmy Cobb has died in New York. And security forces in Indian-administered Kashmir say they've detained a pigeon on suspicion of spying for Pakistan. The World Health Organization has temporarily halted the testing of hydroxychloroquine as a possible treatment for COVID-19 because of safety concerns. The drug, traditionally used to treat malaria, has been described by President Donald Trump as a game changer in the battle against coronavirus. Last week, the president said he was taking it himself.
The frontline workers, many, many are taking it. I happen to be taking it.
Hydroxychloroquine?
I'm taking it. Hydroxychloroquine. A couple of weeks ago, I started taking it. Because I think it's good. I've heard a lot of good stories.
The president has now finished a two-week course of the drug, which has never been recommended as a way of preventing infection. Our Geneva correspondent Imogen Folks told me why the WHO had suspended tests of hydroxychloroquine as a COVID-19 treatment.
The World Health Organization has got a lot of different trials going on. It's called a solidarity trial, where it's taking in evidence from countries all over the world dealing with COVID-19 and looking at what works and what might not work. And there's all sorts of stuff. One of them is hydroxychloroquine. There have been some kind of anecdotal suggestions that it might help in alleviating symptoms, might shorten the time that people are in hospital. But what we saw last week was the first properly gathering together of all of the evidence published in The Lancet, partly carried out, in fact, here in Switzerland by the University of Zurich, I believe, looking at 96,000 patients worldwide. And it suggested that this particular drug, although beneficial in other for other illnesses, it's used to treat malaria, doesn't seem to work with hydroxychloroquine. That's an initial assessment. But the most important thing coming out of that study was that it might make patients worse, that there may be more deaths among patients who've actually taken it than ones who haven't, that there may be side effects to do with heartbeat irregularities, things like that. So what the WHO said today is we are going to suspend trialing of it while we gather more safety data.
But are they still saying that it can be used for things like malaria?
Yes, I think patients who are taking this drug where it has already been tested in these scenarios, malaria, lupus, arthritis, it's already gone through all the drug trials and is on the market. So it is, thought to be beneficial. So patients there shouldn't worry. The evidence that caused this suspension was particularly with COVID-19 patients, that is the setting in which it didn't seem to help. And there's a suggestion that it actually made things worse. So other people taking what is an established drug for established reasons shouldn't worry. But I think it's fair to say what the WHO officials today themselves said: we are doing this out of an abundance of caution. It may be that they will resume trialing. But let's be clear about something else. There is not so far, and the WHO has been saying this for several weeks now, any evidence that hydroxychloroquine can prevent people becoming infected with the coronavirus.
Imogen Folks. He's seen as a political Svengali who likes to stay behind the scenes. However, on Monday afternoon, Dominic Cummings, the top adviser to the British Prime Minister, had to face the press himself after he was accused of breaking the lockdown rules that he helped draw up. Just 4 days after his boss Boris Johnson told the nation to stay at home, Mr. Cummings had driven his wife and child 430 kilometres, all the way from their London house to his parents' farm in the north of England. His wife had developed COVID-19 symptoms, and he said if he fell ill too, there would be no one in London to care for his four-year-old son. The journalist Beth Rigby asked him if he was a hypocrite.
Mr. Cummings, thousands of people watching this, ordinary families, have put up with all kinds of restrictions and hardships. What those people, I think, see here is that there's one rule for you, one of the most powerful people in this country, and there's another rule for them. Don't you think you, at the very least, owe them an apology?
I don't think I'm so different, and I don't think there's one rule for me and one rule for other people. As I said, I think that I knew what the guidance was. It talks about exceptional circumstances with small children, and I think that in all the circumstances, I behaved reasonably and legally, as I said.
Dominic Cummings speaking to the press in the Downing Street Garden. On Sunday, Boris Johnson had staunchly defended his adviser but failed to end the row. He was asked again on Monday if he'd regretted the actions of his adviser.
Do I regret what has happened? And yes, of course, I do regret the confusion and the anger and the pain that people feel, because this is a country that's been going through the most tremendous difficulties and suffering.
Well, I asked our political correspondent Rob Watson if he thought Mr. Cummings' appearance at the news conference would end the row.
I'm tempted to say, come up with the old cliche, time will tell. I think it depends on a couple of things. I think it depends on anger levels among the British public and whether that anger then feeds through to Conservative MPs who then go to Downing Street and to Prime Minister Boris Johnson and say, hey, look, this is just killing us. This is killing us in terms of trust, credibility and authority with the people of Britain at this difficult time. And I guess sort of connected to that first point, you know, will public anger dissipate, is the extent to which the government can get people to focus on what it wants to be the agenda, which is namely its proposals for easing the lockdown in the weeks ahead.
And does it really matter either way? I mean, political advisers come and go, don't they?
They do, normally. I mean, they're a bit like buses. Doesn't matter if you miss one, another one will be along shortly. But this is not the case with Mr. Cummings. I mean, it's difficult to stress enough how important he is. I mean, I don't think anyone at Westminster would say it was an exaggeration to describe him, along with Boris Johnson, as the most important man in British politics. I mean, he is widely credited for being the brains behind Vote Leave, the brains behind Mr. Johnson's decision to call and then win the general election last December. And the sort of general view of their partnership is that Mr. Johnson does the speeches, but that the big ideas, the detail and following it all through, all of that comes from Dominic Cummings.
And I suppose that the question is whether the fact that he interpreted the rules in his own way will lead people to continue to follow the rules as the restrictions are eased, and that is what the government is considering at the moment.
Yes, well, I think you've hit the nail on the head of the problem that the government faces. I mean, you've got two problems. I mean, one is what might be called the authority, credibility, trust problem, this idea that it just looks hypocritical, whatever is extenuating circumstances, that people will just say, hang on a minute, we've been shut up for 2 months, we didn't get to see our mum, we didn't get to see our dad, you know, this is crazy, one rule for the rulers and one rule for the governed. But of course, you know, looking forward, the more important issue is, you know, if in the days ahead the government is going to be setting up one of these tracking, tracing and quarantining systems whereby you're told you have been in touch with someone who's had the virus, you need to stay at home, you need to isolate, that is the question. You know, might people turn around and say, well, Mr. Cummings didn't, why should I?
Rob Watson. The German government has agreed a rescue package of up to 9 billion euros for the country's biggest airline, Lufthansa, which, like most of the industry, has been hit hard by the pandemic. The government will take a 20% stake in the firm. Here's our economics correspondent, Andrew Walker.
The German economy ministry said that before the international health crisis, Lufthansa was an operationally healthy company, that it was profitable and it has good prospects. That has not been enough, however, to protect the business from the severe commercial blow it and other airlines have been dealt by the pandemic. The German government is stepping in to see the company through the crisis with financial support that includes partly nationalising it, though it says it will be a silent partner, which means it plans to stay out of most business decisions.
Andrew Walker. Iran has reopened its major Shia Muslim shrines, which were shut 2 months ago to combat the coronavirus. Worshippers have to abide by social distancing rules and are allowed to access courtyards but not covered areas. At one shrine in the capital, Tehran, visitors had to wear masks, walk through a disinfection tunnel and have their temperatures checked. I got the details from Kazra Naji of the BBC Persian Service.
Well, the shrines have opened from today and the hours of visiting shrines are limited. You can only go there first thing in the morning until before sunset, not in the evenings. You know, the weather is quite hot these days in Iran and people tend to go to the shrines in the evenings. So now they cannot do that. Beyond that, the picture is a bit sort of mixed in Iran, in the sense that the coronavirus daily new cases are up on the rise again. So there are concerns about the second wave starting. And in fact, those figures show that it is going up pretty much. The number of daily deaths is low, has been on a level line, and today was 34, which is the lowest for more than 2 months. So the picture is mixed, but there is real concern that the second wave may have started. When you look at the graph, it shows that it started about the 5th or 4th of May. And don't forget, 2 weeks before it, Iran had begun starting to open shops and shopping centers, and also on those days, 5th or 4th of May, Iran announced that the mosques are going to open again. So there is concern.
Yeah, so, I mean, is it a particular risk opening these shrines, even with these special measures, given that Iran's initial outbreak began among pilgrims in Qom?
That's right. And there's concern for that. But obviously, there's quite a lot of pressure from the religious establishment, the Ayatollahs in Qom and elsewhere, that they want these places open. In fact, they wanted these places open during the Ramadan month. But President Rouhani managed to resist that. But now he's opening these shrines as of today. And he is also, another source of concern is that he is requiring all government employees to go back to work from Saturday, which is the start of the working week in Iran. And that is another source of concern. Beyond that, there are two provinces in the north and also Mazandaran in the north, Khuzestan in the south, and Balochistan in the southeast. They are described as critical provinces, red. That means that they are requiring people to stay indoors as much as possible.
Kazra Naji of the BBC Persian Service. Early action against the coronavirus in the Czech Republic helped limit the total number of deaths there to just over 300. Now the government is lifting restrictions, with many children returning to schools and swimming pools, zoos and castles reopening. And to the delight of the nation's many beer lovers, bars, pubs and restaurants are now able to serve people inside once again. Rob Cameron has this report.
10 weeks after lockdown, and Czechs are once more free to do what they've done for centuries: sit in a pub with a glass of the good stuff and chew the fat, or indeed something more substantial. Not shivering outside in a beer garden or standing by a hatch, inside in the warm, cosy, welcoming surroundings of their local. Like here, Vinohradsky Pivovar, a popular Prague brewery and pub.
It's a great feeling. For the last few weeks, we've been able to go to a beer garden, but that wouldn't really be possible with the weather like it is today. So we're happy to be inside.
Us Czechs are a nation of beer lovers. We've got great beer in this country, and the food here in the brewery is great too. So we're always happy to stop by.
There are rules. Customers are only supposed to lower their face masks, still mandatory everywhere inside, when they're actually taking a sip or a bite, which poses not just logistical problems, but social ones too. Dan Hoydar is the brewery's managing director.
Beer has a very specific place in Czech culture. But when you socialize, it's very hard to have a face covered with a mask because you don't see the face expressions, and face expressions are half of the communication.
But there's a sense those rules may be widely ignored, especially after people have had a few. And in the land which effectively invented lager back in 1842, good luck trying to find a police officer to enforce them.
Rob Cameron. Still to come in the podcast, the story of one of the many surrogate babies stuck in Ukraine.
I'm curious and interested, but I do not have a mother's love for him. I have my own child that I need to look after and raise.
Inevitably, the total death toll from coronavirus goes up every day. But in Spain, the overall count has been lowered by nearly 2,000 to under 27,000. Officials say some deaths had been counted twice, while other suspected cases of COVID-19 hadn't been confirmed. Spain is continuing to ease its lockdown, and from July, it will lift its quarantine for international travellers. From Madrid, Guy Hedgeco reports.
Since mid-May, foreigners visiting Spain have had to go into quarantine for 2 weeks on arrival as part of the country's strict lockdown. But having already signalled that Spain would welcome international tourism again this summer, the government has now said that the quarantine controls will be lifted from the beginning of July. Spain receives more than 80 million visitors from abroad each year, and the tourism industry has already suffered enormously in recent weeks due to the impact of coronavirus. This measure comes as the country continues with a gradual and staggered lifting of its lockdown. Today, Madrid and Barcelona, which have been particularly heavily hit by the pandemic, moved into the next phase of the so-called de-escalation. Bars and restaurants have been opened in the two cities, although they can only serve customers outside, and shopping restrictions have been eased.
Guy Hedgeco. Other news now, and a former Saudi security official who lives in exile says two of his children are being held hostage to try to force him to return to Saudi Arabia. Saad al-Jabri is said to have prevented a major attack by al-Qaeda a decade ago. He says he hasn't heard from his son or daughter since they were detained in Riyadh more than 2 months ago. Here's our security correspondent, Frank Gardner.
Western intelligence officers who worked on counter-terrorism with Saudi Arabia's Dr. Saad al-Jabri are unequivocal. They say this former major general was instrumental in saving hundreds of lives by helping Britain's MI6 secret intelligence service foil an al-Qaeda plot to blow up a cargo aircraft over Chicago in 2010. Thanks to a tip-off from Saudi intelligence, police were able to locate the bomb hidden inside a printer ink toner cartridge, but Dr. al-Jabri has since fallen out with Saudi Arabia's powerful crown prince, who is believed to view him as a political threat. Dr. al-Jabri lives in self-imposed exile in Canada, and in March his two youngest children were seized by security forces from their home in Riyadh. His eldest son, Khalid, has told the BBC he believes this is intended to force their father to return to Saudi Arabia and to an uncertain fate.
Right now, effectively, they are hostages, and the ransom is my father's return.
Will your father return to Saudi Arabia?
Absolutely not. At this point, it's suicidal. If two of his children, who have nothing whatsoever to do with this, had been treated in this manner, can you imagine what would happen to their father?
Former intelligence officials say Dr. al-Jabri successfully transformed Saudi counter-terrorism efforts from crude interrogations to forensic analysis and data mining. But his former boss, a deposed crown prince, is under arrest, and Dr. al-Jabri annoyed the current de facto ruler by opposing Saudi Arabia's involvement in Yemen's civil war. His family say they've received threats, which the Canadian authorities are taking seriously.
Frank Gardner. The BBC has been told that more than 100 newborn surrogate babies are now stranded in Ukraine because of coronavirus restrictions. Some are stuck because flights have been cancelled, while countries who oppose surrogacy have refused to help parents get special permission to go to Ukraine. Our correspondent Jonah Fisher has been following the story of one separated family.
When we meet Manu, he's clinging to the shoulder of his nanny, Olga. just 8 weeks old. He's got chubby cheeks and wide-open eyes. Manu was born to a surrogate Ukrainian mother, but is the biological child of Jose and Flavia from Argentina. They've never met him. Nearly 13,000 kilometres away, Flavia is preparing Manu's room. The cot is ready and the teddies all lined up. Just as Jose and Flavia made the final preparations to go to Ukraine for the birth of their son, disaster struck. Coronavirus meant Ukraine closing its borders and Argentina cancelling all commercial flights. Manu was born, taken from his surrogate, and put in a hotel room with 30 other stranded babies. To wait. Jose and Flavia have watched the photos and videos sent by the nannies 1,000 times.
Él no sabe sonreír porque no vio una sonrisa. Las chicas están todas con barbijo.
I'm worried that he doesn't know how to smile because the nannies all wear face masks. So he's never seen a smile. How can Manu learn to smile if he's never seen one?
Son semanas que se hacen.
For weeks, we've been so stressed.
En algún momento con mucha esperanza.
Sometimes we've had hope.
Y otra.
Sometimes not.
In a small pokey apartment in Kiev, we meet up with the other side of the story. Luciana is both a mum to 4-year-old Anastasia and a surrogate mother. A student from a poor part of Ukraine, 2 weeks ago she was paid $16,000 after she gave birth to a healthy boy.
Do you love that baby?
I'm curious and interested, but I do not have a mother's love for him. I have my own child that I need to look after and raise.
Ukraine is one of the few countries in the world where commercial surrogacy is legal. It's helped it become one of the most popular destinations for childless couples. But with weak regulation, there's little to fall back on when things go wrong.
Hello. Hi Flavia, hi Jose, how are you doing?
At Manu's hotel, we helped arrange a video call so his parents could see him live from Argentina.
This is Olga.
Hola.
Está dormido.
Hola Manu.
The little boy sits on Olga's lap.
Estamos moviendo montañas para llegar a
Manu. We're moving mountains to be with you, Manu. When we reach you, we will never stop hugging you.
After 10 minutes, Manu dozes off to the sound of his father's voice. He's taken back to the room where he sleeps with the other stranded babies. All of them waiting for this to be over and for their parents to come and claim them.
Jonah Fisher reporting from Ukraine. Security forces in Indian-administered Kashmir say they've detained a pigeon on suspicion of spying for Pakistan along the international border. They say the bird had a ring with a coded message attached to one of its legs, and they're now working to decipher it. The bird was spotted and captured by villagers who said it flew in from the Pakistani side of the frontier. And Rasan Etirajan has more details.
India and Pakistan have arrested suspected spies along the border in the past, but it's rare for a bird to be detained on charges of spying. Pigeons have been used for centuries to send messages, and it seems they are still in service, competing with surveillance drones. In a similar incident in 2015, Indian security forces captured a pigeon suspected of spying for Pakistan.
And Barasen Etirajan. And we end this edition of the podcast with one of the most famous pieces of jazz from the 20th century. So What from Miles Davis's 1959 album Kind of Blue. The drummer was Jimmy Cobb, who's died in New York at the age of 91. He had lung cancer. Jimmy Cobb was the last survivor of the six musicians who made the record the best-selling jazz album ever. Speaking to Witness on the BBC World Service in 2014, Jimmy Cobb said that his laid-back style came about just by talking to Miles Davis.
I didn't have any kind of business. What I got was conversation from him, you know, like, you know, because he would just say to me, you know, well, just play this soft and make it sound like it's floating. But, you know, he kind of picked you before you got there, you know, because he used to say, if I have somebody in the band and I bounce something off and I can't get nothing back, you know, then I know I got the wrong guy, you know.
Jimmy Cobb went on to play with Miles Davis on his Sketches of Spain album, as well as with Dinah Washington, Sarah Vaughan, Billie Holiday and Dizzy Gillespie. Jimmy Cobb continued performing until very recently. And you can still download that edition of Witness from the BBC World Service website. And that's all from us. For now, there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.